The people we learned about in school and the major figures in our history tended to be men. No big surprise, men ruled society, denied many rights to women, and wrote many of the history books. But as your own daily life should tell you, it takes a lot of different people to make society work. So we get a more nuanced view of history in a book about women in history in our part of the world. Sue Armitage is the author of Shaping the Public Good, Women Making History in the Pacific Northwest. Sue Armitage spent 30 years teaching and writing about women in the American West from her position as professor of history and women's studies at Washington State University in Pullman. She is the co-editor of five books, including The Women's West. Sue Armitage, thanks for joining us.
Thanks. It's nice of you to invite me.
So first off, this is not just since white settlement. Tell us how far back you went.
As far as I could. My idea was to essentially write the history of this region of the country, the Pacific Northwest, and to go from the earliest people we knew about to as close to the present as I could get. So that was a big span, and once in a while I would think, good Lord, what am I doing? But it's perfectly obvious that for that very early period, and I'm talking, 10, 12,000 years ago, what we know is pretty skimpy, except that there's a pretty good sense of what continued in Native societies. So I didn't feel completely making it up by starting there.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was an important example because it's very clear that women and men divided up the tasks, which were mainly staying alive and having enough food, pretty equally, and there are records of that. So it was a great place to start by just seeing how essential women were to the entire society.
Before your first words is a picture of a face in a rock, and this takes us way back in time. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that's the famous image called She Who Watches, which is a big petroglyph that still exists along the Columbia River. And I took her as my sort of talisman for this entire book, because the story that's told about her is that long, long ago, she was the chief of her region, and a very good chief. She took care of her people. She made sure they did the right things, all the rest of it. And then, as the story goes, it's a Wishram story. Coyote, the famous trickster figure, came up the Columbia River and said, pretty soon women aren't going to be allowed to run things anymore. You can't be the chief. And she was very upset to hear that. And he said, sort of, in sympathy with her, he said, well, I'll turn you into a rock and you'll always be there and you can continue your role looking after your people. And I took that as sort of a touchstone for the entire book. In fact, I really wanted to have her image on the cover, but I couldn't talk the press into it. But the idea being that whether women are in official positions or not, it doesn't mean they're not doing anything and doing something that's important to society. So my sense of her image and what the story means is that whatever their role in society, women are making major contributions to the public good, and that's where the title finally came from.
Sure, it is Shaping the Public Good, Women Making History in the Pacific Northwest. So they obviously worked a little more quietly than the men on behalf of their people. And is it possible, as you were pointing out, we just can't know many of the stories, it sounds like, because men ran things for ages and we didn't keep good written records, any written records in many cases.
Well, that's what women's historians like me have been doing for the last 20 or 30 years, which is digging out the evidence wherever it might be. And, of course, for the ancient people, there's good anthropological records. They're thin. I'm not saying they would stand up to our current standards, but they're good enough to give a sense of how a native society lived. And the most obvious thing for our area, or the Columbia River area, of the Pacific Northwest, is that tribal groups spent a good half the year moving around from place to place, the so-called seasonal round. They went where the food was. When the camas bloomed and roots could be dug, they went there. When the salmon, various salmon runs came up the river, they would go to the river, to Celilo and other spots, and so forth and so on, ending up with huckleberry picking in August and September in the higher elevations. And that was the food. And more than half of it, really, was roots and berries and the various things that women gathered as the men were fishing and hunting.
So very clearly defined roles in Native society. And is that, no matter where people lived in the Northwest, very similar division of roles?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, tribal societies everywhere, especially hunting and gathering societies as they're known worldwide. The women do the gathering and the men do the hunting. And it's a really interesting division of labor, because the women are paying attention all the time to whatever is growing right around them, you know, whatever is going to bloom next or whatever. Whereas fishing and hunting are much more sort of intense and not as long-lasting. It's a very interesting division of perspective.
Indeed, and we'll pick it up on the other side of a break. We're going to go to one now. We're going to talk to Sue Armitage some more about shaping the public good, women making history in the Pacific Northwest. You can join us on The Exchange. We'll return in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Sue Armitage, who spent 30 years teaching and writing about women in the American West as professor of history and women's studies at Washington State in Pullman. She's written a book called Shaping the Public Good, Women Making History in the Pacific Northwest. It's a very wide-ranging and long-ranging view in time, back 10 or 12,000 years, because it takes in Native societies as well, published by Oregon State University Press. You can join the discussion on The Exchange about women and their influence on the Northwest through centuries at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Sue, when I look at how you describe women in all of the cultures in this book, it seems like women are basically protein. They're there for growth and repair.
Yes. I think that's it goes beyond that, but I would say those are the basic roles. I mean, you have to think about what a society needs to form and to grow and to thrive, and those are the basic things that have to be done, and somebodies have to do them. And we tend to sort of lump that all together into something that we call a domestic role, but that's really doesn't really do it credit, it seems to me.
But it's interesting how the domestic roles translate into some sort of larger perspective on these are the things we need to do to get through every day. And by getting through every day, we become a successful society.
Yeah, yeah. And you need to understand, I don't want to spend very much time on this, but the kind of history that this book represents is what I think is the real history. Lots of people remember taking history in high school, and they remember names and dates and very boring things, and they never want to look at a history book again. But the real story of how societies form and grow is just this kind of thing, sort of a grassroots sort of thing, and women's history is a great way to get at that.
And do you have, I'm going to ask you about some of these the oral histories from women tribal members from recent history and how vivid they might be. Agnes Alfred is one name you mentioned in here.
She's a fascinating figure from the northern part of Vancouver Island in what's now British Columbia. Definitely, deeply into a very traditional tribal society. But she has to make the transition to the modern world. And her husband, who is transitioning, you might say, faster than she is, builds a modern house and insist that she move into it instead of into the longhouse, from the longhouse from which she had grown up. And she has to confront modern appliances. And apparently, although the children don't fill out the full details, there's some very funny stories about, imagine facing a wood-burning stove for the first time, mm-hmm. or a washing machine or something like that. But she sort of had a foot in both camps. She was a repository of tribal knowledge, and she could repeat lineages and histories, native histories. She really was essentially a historical resource for her entire tribe. But she was in the modern world, too. And she was arrested by the British Columbia authorities several times for belonging to tribal groups that were trying to preserve traditions, like the famous potlatch ceremony that the authorities in British Columbia, the white authorities, thought were damaging, that they were keeping tribal people back in traditional ways. Now, of course, we want to know as much about some of those traditional ways as we possibly can, but a lot's been lost.
It has, and one of the things that you do very successfully in the book is give us an idea of how long cultures were exposed to each other. I mean, we had fur trappers and traders in the region long before pioneers arrived, and a lot of intermingling of cultures and people and intermarriage, mm-hmm. and things like that. First contact stories, though, one of the most interesting ones is the story here that you quote from the Clatsop, of a woman uh-huh. coming down the beach and seeing a ship.
And she doesn't know what it is. Mm-hmm. She thinks it's a whale. And then she notices that it's got trees growing on it and various other things that you finally realize it's got to be a sailing ship. And it's, from the native view, what they want, well, as soon as she alerts everybody to the fact that there is this ship, they want the copper. They want the metal in the ship. And as best I can tell from that account, they stripped the ship, not for the things that we would expect, but for the basic metals, which were very valuable in their culture. And then those two poor men, we'll never know who they were, that she originally thought were bears and finally realized must be men. One went to one village and one went to another as captives, and that's the end of the story about them. So, but what I really like about that story is her perception. I mean, she doesn't know what to do with it. I mean, it must be a whale. She's never seen a sailing ship.
Right. Yeah, and the description of the mast says trees growing on the ship. Yeah, that's mm-hmm. some great stuff. Mm-hmm. Sue Armitage is our guest on The Exchange. Her book is Shaping the Public Good, Women Making History in the Pacific Northwest. I did mention briefly about some intermarrying. I mean, how quickly and early did Europeans and natives begin marrying?
Oh, right away. I'm not sure they all married, but there certainly was sexual contact from the very beginning. I mean, after all, the first contacts come from sailors who've been sailing around the Horn and out in the ocean for months, maybe years. So naturally, as soon as they get to shore, they're interested in the women. So there's a whole range of things that happen. There's some stuff at one level, which we would call either rape or prostitution. And then there's stable marriages at the other end. It depended partly on the individuals and partly on the circumstances.
And so for a couple of centuries, then we've got Western men, or what we consider Western European men, coming in contact with native women. Mm-hmm. The first women to women contact, it seemed like, was missionaries and natives. And how did that go?
Yeah, badly, very badly. From our point of view, at least today, I mean, the missionary women came to turn all Indians, male and female, into well-behaved Christian people. I mean, they did have a missionary spirit, and they believed firmly that the natives had to accept Christianity, and that meant Christian behavior, which was not the way the native women lived. And for example, when Narcissa Whitman, the famous Narcissa Whitman, talks about Indian women for the first time, she talks about how hard they work and how lazy their husbands are. And what she's really seeing is the women at the height of their hunting and their gathering activities, gathering the things the tribe will need for the next year. And she sees them as overworked drudges, basically. And the men who have long periods when, for example, the salmon aren't running, seem to be just lounging around doing nothing. So she doesn't, just because they're both women, doesn't mean that they understand what the other one is doing. Presumably, although we don't have any accounts, it would be wonderful to hear what some of those first Native women thought about Narcissa Whitman.
Boy, it would be interesting, yes, because it sounds like Narcissa Whitman took a snapshot and assumed that that was the entire photo album.
Yeah, yeah. And she disapproved of the work that Native women were doing. And the kind of work they were doing was keeping their society alive.
So we're talking with Sue Armitage from formerly of Washington State University. She's Professor Emerita there of History and Women's Studies and the author of Shaping the Public Good, Women Making History in the Pacific Northwest. Let me emphasize, women making history in the Pacific Northwest. This is a discussion you're more than welcome to join. There's lots to talk about dating back about 10,000, 12,000 years. 800-838-3760 to get in by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So let's talk about the westward settlement along the Oregon Trail, and give us a flavor. You have some great stories in here from the likes of Elizabeth Dixon Smith. What did she experience?
Oh, more than I would ever want to. And her account, it was in one of the early wagon trains. It was in the 1840, forget the year right now, but it was still at a point where the trail was not necessarily very well marked, very well traveled yet. And she encountered all the things that all the accounts talk about one way or another, the changing weather. One of the things that really struck me was when the train finally gets to southern Idaho, it is so dry, they can hardly believe it. And I have this vivid image of some of these trains straggling along what would now be the interstate in, like, it near Baker City, where it's so very dry before they hit the Blue Mountains, and they're exhausted, and they have to get over the mountains and into finally to the Columbia River, and then the deer party have a terrible time getting down the river. They have to wait for a long time. They get on rafts, and she has this vivid description of sort of being, surrounded by children, at least a babe in arms, somebody clinging to her skirt, and of course it's raining. And they're trying to make their way down the river, and they finally end up in Portland. They probably actually end up in Oregon City. Since the town didn't exist, she didn't really say. And then her husband dies. After all of this struggle, her husband, who caught one of those diseases along the way, dies. And there she is. She says, in a phrase I will never forget, she says, "I was as poor as a snake."
Wow.
And then she makes her way up from there. I mean, she has skills. She probably knit socks, which were... which they could make money out of. And during the gold rush, a little bit later on, lots of women whose husbands rushed off to the gold field survived by knitting socks and selling them. I think it was for 50 cents a pair, maybe. And other skills like that, taking in washing, doing all those other things. And then even a bit later in the early settlement period, women are making butter at just astounding rates. I mean, they're basically keeping the whole economy afloat by churning butter and selling it. It's an amazing record.
It truly is, and obviously they had to work hard once they got here. It wasn't like they got to their reward at the end of the trail and got to relax.
Oh, because, no, not at all.
No.
And that's why the diaries stop. I mean, they don't have any, it's not just that they've finally gotten here, it's that they're so much even more busy than they were on the trail, that they don't have time to write in diaries. The record is really very thin.
Well, there's some great stuff in here, though, from Abigail Scott Dunaway, whose name I think we've all heard before, but but she describes her own experience in these days as well.
Yeah, yeah. She has this vivid portrait of what does she call it, a pioneer drudge, I think, or something like that. And she describes in some detail exactly what it was that she was doing that made her so busy. And her husband, I mean, she's the first to say her husband was just as busy. Here it is, to bear 2 children in 2.5 years from my marriage day, to make thousands of pounds of butter every year for the market, to sew and cook and wash and iron and bake and clean and stew and fry, to be, in short, a general pioneer drudge with never a penny of my own, et cetera, because the money had to go to keeping the farm going. And everybody understood that, and it was perfectly understandable. But she did have a very sharp pen. I mean, that's as, and that's as far from the ideal of the pioneer woman, describing herself as a general pioneer drudge.
She laid it out plain. We're talking to Sue Armitage about her book of women in the Northwest in history called Shaping the Public Good. You point out, too, and in fact there was a hint of it there in what Abigail Scott Dunaway wrote about quickly having 2 children. Women were very fertile once settled here. I mean, even more so than they were in the homes they came from?
Oh, yes, very much more. Very much more. It's clear that part of the sense of what it meant to pioneer, to move to such a different place and to settle, was to have lots of children to populate the area and for helping on the farm. I mean, it was meant, they meant to be fertile, and a lot of them were very.
You know, and I got a little excited here when I saw that there was some legal recognition that at least women existed, but it was still sort of as a tool. And a particular case in point is the Donation Land Claim Act.
Yeah, yeah, that's a very unusual act. And if you look at it superficially, there's a grant of free land both to the man and to his wife. And you think, oh my, okay, there's a real recognition of women's work, but it's not. It's about establishing very large farms so that you can pass your acreage down to your children, who of course would be your male children who would inherit, because women don't have very many legal rights. And even though women had land in their own name, they couldn't sell it without their husband's permission. So it's pretty well hedged around. I mean, it acknowledges that women are there, but it's a way of furthering what I called at that point the family claim. And that was the ideal. You move with your family. Say you're a family and the parents are in their 40s, well, your children, your oldest young children, if you want to put it that way, the ones in their 20s who are already married, they come too, and their children. So you've got, and Oregon was really unique in this family migration, and the idea that there would be enough land so that the families could be there for generation after generation.
That seems like that's still sort of stuck in Oregon thinking.
Yeah, yeah. It's not true anymore. I mean, people don't live that way. And in fact, even those people with donation land claims managed to sell them off fairly fast. But that was the ideal. And that's what many, not everybody, of course, but that's what many people came for, was that sense that it's for the family, the multi-generational family.
But
and with the father, I might say, the adult of it all, being very patriarchal, being in charge of saying to their sons, for example, you can do this, you can't do that, you must stay, and you can't go on the gold rush. I'm going to the gold rush, but you can't go because you have to stay here and take care of the land.
Huh. We'll get to the gold rush in just a moment in greater detail because this is a really interesting portion of Northwest history. We'll come back and talk more with Sue Armitage, formerly of Washington State University, writing about women making history in the Pacific Northwest in her book Shaping the Public Good, out on Oregon State University Press. We'll come back and talk more with Sue. And if you'd like to join the conversation, we'll take phone calls and emails from you when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 25. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Sue Armitage, a professor emerita of history and women's studies at Washington State University in Pullman. She has written a book about the history of women in the Northwest. It's called Shaping the Public Good, subtitled Women Making History in the Pacific Northwest. You can join the conversation as we range back about 12,000 years to the very first history of anybody doing anything in the Northwest, right up to the present day. We've reached the pioneer days in the middle 1800s. You can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone and by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So we were just beginning to talk about the gold rush years, and this really reminds me of America and World War II. It seems like men pretty much left the landscape all at once.
Yeah, I mean, especially the California Gold Rush, which, of course, was the first major one. Here were all these men who had not been in Oregon all that long, but they were so close to California. So naturally, everybody who could, all the men who could, went to California, leaving their wives to take care of the farms and the family and all the rest of it. And there were some hard times for a lot of the women who were left behind. Others probably enjoyed the chance to be in charge and decide what got to be done. But for a while, the men just basically, a large majority of men left. And in fact, there's one account that says that there were something like, which can't really be true, it says something like there were only three men left in Portland, and the women were basically running everything.
Huh.
And of course they came back, most of them.
Right.
Some of them just simply disappeared and never did come back. But so you've got, on the one hand, you've got the men disappearing from this really pretty new settlement in Oregon. But in the gold towns, the women who went with their husbands, the women who said, you're not leaving me behind, made often, mostly, more money than their husbands did, because all of those domestic skills, cooking and cleaning and providing boarding houses and stuff like that, were in very short supply. So the very domestic skills that men at home tended to take for granted earned money for women in the gold rush towns.
So all of the thing, all the mending of socks and making of clothing and all those things came in as highly useful skills in a town that was heavily populated by men.
Oh, yeah. Cooking, especially. And so it's a fascinating contrast, depending on where you are. But, I mean, the most people, when they think of gold rush towns, immediately think of prostitution and women. And that certainly was a feature of gold rush towns, but it's not the most important thing. I mean, it's the so-called respectable women who are providing the basic, you know, the living services like cooking and a place to sleep and things like that.
So from what you've been able to ascertain through your research, I mean, how prevalent was prostitution in some of these mining towns and camps?
Oh, quite a bit. I mean, there's no question about that. There was a lot of it, but they were not usually, except in big established towns, they were not independent women really sort of more or less in control of their lives. They were some poor handful of women who'd been gathered up by saloon keepers and people like that, usually men, who transported these women to whatever town it was that gold had been discovered, and who were ready to move on to the next town when the current strike petered out. It's not at all, I mean, it's just amazing how glamorized prostitution has become when it's really such a sordid trade. And that's where you find the women of color. That's where you find the really miserable circumstances. So it's a mystery to me that we have so romanticized that part of the gold rushes.
In fact, you get into rather fine detail on some of that. The cribs, I think you call them, that they were brought to some of these towns.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And in some places, particularly on the coast, it was, again, as I was saying, women of color, Chinese women in these shacks that had a bed and nothing else, and lines of men waiting their turn. Pretty miserable stuff.
Truly.
And then the other aspect that I truthfully had not fully thought about ahead of time is what a gold rush does to the native societies that are already there. All of a sudden, you've got this bunch of men roaring through your village, grabbing food, raping women, totally disrupting native societies. I mean, it was the gold rushes more than anything else, so far as I can tell, that made native people think that they'd be safer on reservations than they would out in the world where all these men were rampaging around. And I suppose that's too broad a statement, but it was just incredibly disruptive. And then there's always, you know, there's always that factor of disease, the ones that the smallpox, for example, that whites were more or less inoculated against. Measles is the famous one from the Whitman mission. The whites are fine. They get measles and recover, and natives get measles and they die. So there's a lot of devastation, and of course gold rushes, as we know from some locations, just tear up the landscape too.
Oh yeah, truly. Let's take a call. We have Connie and Eugene on the line. I think she's talking in the same vein you're talking about. Yeah. We're talking to Sue Armitage about shaping the public good. Hi, Connie.
Hi. Yes, you've just touched on it. I know some of the early records of particularly women, early women, amateur anthropologists who had contact with Native women and dealing with the tremendous amount of death that came as a result of disease after white contact. There's some great early work with that and the tremendous depression. You know, why have a child, you know, if the child is going to die? That kind of feeling, and even in my own family in the Anglo or European, is the tremendous amount of death that came. You had a lot of births, a lot of death, both of men and children. So
yes.
I always think of this period of time that, you know, women had to deal with death constantly, and they often did all the work with the bodies and preparing and that sort of thing. So death was a profound part of that early life, whether Native American or European.
All right, thanks for that, Connie. Appreciate it.
Yes, that's true. It's true. I mean, and it's that's not usually what we think about. But think about it this way, in the extreme phrase, being surrounded by death. Actually, the truer way to put it was that it was so constant. Children didn't live. Young adults got tuberculosis and faded away. It's all around. And as Connie says, it's women's job both to nurse people who are sick and to lay out bodies for burial.
Yeah, all kinds of death in the process. I want to talk about some of the other aspects of life in the 19th century in the Northwest. And I'm struck by the accounts of settler women referring to life back in the States.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting.
Well, they left They left their entire families behind, their birth families. And so a tremendous amount of the correspondence that exists, and we don't, obviously we just have a fraction of the letters that people actually wrote. People wanted to know what was happening, not only to their immediate family, but to whatever the village was they left behind. And again, and partly, it's women's jobs to write the letters that find out what's happening with the family back home. It's a way of staying in touch. And one of the letter collections that I was looking at the Oregon Historical Society is really interesting because in the early years, of course, there's a lot of family news to send west to the people who are way out there somewhere. And then as the years go by, the letters, you've got a habit of letter writing, but there's less and less to write about in a lot of ways. And because society, as all do, is moving in a different direction. And the person who's out in the West, this is the Stevenson papers that I was looking at, she doesn't know anybody in the community she left behind.
Right.
So I never thought about that. I never thought about what a range of letters over, say, 30 or 40 years would mean and how it would change. But yeah, at first, I mean, it was pretty lonely out here, I think. I mean, you're building a new community, but the one you really know is the one you left behind.
I want to talk about some of the women who shared stories of what life in the West was like at the time. And one of them you mentioned here is Sarah Winnemucca. Tell us about her and how she told her story.
She was a Northern Paiute, and her father, had trained her to be sort of the spokeswoman for the tribe after he died, and to be an interpreter and an in-between figure between the tribe and the military mainly, who kept moving her tribe around. And there were various disturbances, and the final thing was that they moved this tribe from Nevada, I think, up to the Yakima Reservation along the Columbia River in Washington, completely regardless of the fact that the Paiute and the Yakima were traditional enemies. And there was this, she's got a horrible description of a winter march from the Nevada location to Yakima, and the complete lack of any preparation for them, so that they were as forlorn when they got to Washington as they were when in the move itself. But then, I mean, because she was so indignant about all of this, and she was convinced, rightly as it turned out, that most Indian agents were corrupt, she did a big speaking tour on the East Coast, and she was sort of adopted by a couple of well-known women in the East who set up this lecture tour for her. And she's apparently a wonderful speaker and very affecting. But she kept, it's a very interesting case of what you might call sympathy fatigue. After a year or so, her audiences were moved, but the officials in Washington were not willing to change any policy at all. So she poured her heart into this and basically got very little back in return. It's a really sad story.
And it's followed up quickly by your reporting on the Dawes Act, which sounds like it totally misread Native nuclear families.
Yeah. They really, I mean, this is, I suppose we have blind spots today that are just as awful. But the very fact that the idea that you could take these peoples who were accustomed to movement and activity and living on the land in a way that, for example, farmers never do, that you could turn them into nuclear farming families was a really not just ridiculous but devastating idea, and But that was the policy that was decided in the 1880s, and it did a good deal to destroy what was left of the morale of Native peoples living on reservations. And what happened, if you look at a map now of areas around reservations, you'll find that within the reservation boundaries, there's a lot of white ownership because at various times Indians sold their land to people who did know how to farm and wanted to farm and knew and had the money to do it. And so there's very little control even now over large portions of tribal lands.
Well, the book certainly helps us understand a lot better about how we got the society we have today and the relations between different kinds of people in the Northwest. It's called Shaping the Public Good, Women Making History in the Pacific Northwest. Sue Armitage, Professor Emerita of History and Women's Studies at Washington State, wrote the book and joined us today in the exchange. Sue, thank you.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed talking to you.
We did too. Take care. And that'll do it for today's exchange. You can find out more about the program and subjects online at jeffexchange.org. Check us out on Facebook and Twitter as well. If you're listening in the morning, the takeaways coming up next. Our evening rebroadcast is followed by news from the BBC. The exchange is produced by Emily Curitan of JPR News. Colleen Pike is at the controls today. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Please join us next time on the Jefferson Exchange, and have a great day.